Welcome back to the show. I'm Maya Schwader. Today, we're going to be talking about chemicals. And unfortunately, these are not happy, healthy chemicals. You may have heard of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. Three things to know. One, they're everywhere, usually sprayed as a finish on tons of consumer products or included in their packaging. Two, evidence suggests that they're very bad for us. And three, once they're in your system or in the environment around you, they are very hard to get rid of. Now, yesterday, the Joint Committee on Public Health held a hearing about a Senate bill that, if passed, would be one of the most sweeping bans of PFAS in the nation. Later, we'll talk to State Senator Joe Comerford, who chairs the Joint Committee, and introduce the bill. She said she was inspired to take action by a group of her own constituents who are some of the world's leading experts on PFAS.
And I'm Dara Kennedy. Yes, lots of acronyms will be used in today's show, but the takeaway from learning what they mean, says Dr. Laura Schader, is to help protect your family and ask your lawmakers for help. A scientist at the Silent Spring Institute, she leads the Institute's water quality research on highly fluorinated chemicals, code for PFAS. And she spoke at the hearing yesterday. In order to better understand the bills on the table and another thing, ask her to first tell us what this invisible chemical is.
PFAS is a class of chemicals that are widely used in many everyday consumer products. PFAS isn't necessarily a household name, but products containing PFAS are familiar to all of us. So think of Teflon pans, Gore-Tex jackets, or Stainmaster, Scotchgard treated carpets and upholstery. PFAS also show up in a lot of products where there's no trademark to give us a clue where they might be. Most recently, I've learned about climbing ropes and guitar strings and dental floss. Can contain PFAS as well. These have really gotten people's attention in recent years because they have also been detected in drinking water supplies all across the country, and that's raising many concerns.
So it's a substance, it's a chemical, is that right? Is it a man-made chemical?
PFAS are a class of man-made chemicals, yes. It includes over 9,000 different compounds. It's a broad chemical distinction that includes many different members.
So a regular family having takeout on the weekend would be maybe exposed to PFAS somewhere?
So all of us really are exposed to PFAS. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has conducted representative sampling of PFAS in people's blood, and pretty much every single person whose blood they test have some level of PFAS in our bodies. So that can come from a number of different places. You mentioned takeout containers. Food packaging can definitely be one source of exposure, as well as things like microwave popcorn bags. The food itself may actually have PFAS, depending on whether there is any environmental contamination, where the crops are grown, or where fish are living, or where livestock are raised. And we can also be exposed from the products in our homes as well. And for some communities, drinking water can be a source of exposure.
Are there federal regulatory limits for PFASs in drinking water?
It's a great question. So despite the fact that PFAS are showing up in so many water supplies and have been linked with a wide range of health effects, there are currently no federal drinking water standards for any PFAS chemicals. Two specific members of this family in particular, they're called PFOS and PFOA, are currently included in a guideline that's been developed by the EPA. The EPA set that at 70 parts per trillion back in 2016, but it's not enforceable. Now, a number of states have decided that that guideline is not adequately protective of people's health, including here in Massachusetts, have taken steps to put in place stricter guidelines or standards. We're 3 times stricter than the EPA guideline and one of the strictest in the country.
I guess the next question would be, how does it affect people's health?
So that's a great question as well. And this is really an active area of research. There are a handful of PFAS that have been extensively studied in terms of their health effects. And exposures to PFAS have been linked with many different kinds of health effects. For instance, exposures to PFAS have been linked to elevated cholesterol, effects on the thyroid, to more severe outcomes like testicular and kidney cancer. One type of health effect that is getting a lot of people's attention these days as we're, looking at the pandemic and hopefully looking at it mostly in the past, but there are concerns that exposures to PFAS can actually impair the body's ability to create antibodies. And that's been on everyone's mind with the vaccine rollout. Antibodies are the response that our bodies mount after receiving a vaccination, kind of priming the body to fight off a virus or bacteria if we get exposed to it down the road. Research has suggested, has found associations between higher PFAS levels and reduced antibody response. But it is an important question for us to understand.
So I just want to go back to that. What you're saying is that it is possible that PFAS can interfere with the vaccines if you've been exposed.
So based on other research on children and routine vaccinations, studies have found that antibody response is suppressed in children that have higher PFAS exposures. That work hasn't yet been done for COVID, and researchers are investigating this question now.
How do people know if they've been exposed to PFAS?
Well, that's another great question. And unfortunately, there's really no easy way to tell. I would say it's a safe assumption that all of us have been exposed at some level. But there are people in communities where there's been severe water contamination or environmental contamination who really want to know what the levels of PFAS are in their blood or perhaps in their children's blood. It can be difficult to get blood testing for PFAS, but it is possible. There are labs that will analyze blood samples from individuals. The testing can be expensive, and you may not be able to get your insurance provider. But that is one way to provide some sense of the level of exposure that you've had. And that's helpful information.
I know you mentioned that it's in so many different forms and there are no labels. What can families do to limit their exposure?
Sure. Well, first I want to say that I don't think it should be up to individuals to have to figure out what toxic chemicals might be in the food they're buying or in the products that they're purchasing for their families and for their homes and workplaces. But unfortunately, many chemicals are widely accepted for use prior to really thorough and adequate safety testing. If you're on a public water supply, some filters can remove PFAS if that is an issue in your community. In terms of food, there are some steps that we can take. For instance, eating more fresh foods is likely to reduce your PFAS exposure because there's less contact between the food and packaging. But I think more broadly, this also requires collective action. And then another thing that people can do is to learn about any legislation that's underway. Here in Massachusetts, there are some bills that are being considered specifically related to PFAS. Just yesterday, in fact, I provided scientific testimony at a hearing at the State House related to banning PFAS in certain consumer products. So people can learn about those bills. I would point people to a website that I've developed with our team of researchers at Silent Spring Institute and other research institutions called the PFAS Exchange. So it's PFAS-exchange.org. And people can learn more about how to reduce their exposures to PFAS and find out more resources, particularly if they're in a community where water has been contaminated by PFAS.
That was Dr. Laurel Shader, former research associate at the Harvard School of Public Health and current lead research scientist on PFAS at the Silent Spring Institute.
So now that we're all up to date on what these chemicals are, the next question is, well, if they're already in our skin and our plastic and our clothes, what do we do about it? State Senator Jo Comerford has one potential answer. She recently introduced a bill that would ban PFAS in most consumer products in Massachusetts. Last night, she oversaw a public hearing about it, and we asked her to lay out for us what this bill does.
The bill that we're talking about is S-1387, an act restricting toxic PFAS chemicals in consumer products to protect our health. What it does is it helps turn off the tap of PFAS in the Commonwealth. It would ban toxic PFAS from carpets, rugs, furniture, textiles, from aftermarket sprays applied to these products. It also bans PFAS in personal care products and cookware. So a range of consumer goods would no longer be able to have PFAS as part of their makeup if they're sold in the Commonwealth.
And would Massachusetts be the first state to pass a bill like this if it were to pass?
This sweeping a bill, yes. However, it's important to know that states like Vermont, for example, passed a ban on PFAS in carpets and rugs. California and Washington are in the process of banning PFAS in carpets and rugs and aftermarket sprays to carpets and textiles. So other states are awake to the real significant danger of PFAS and acting, which is why I'm really hoping that Massachusetts can take this leap, this urgently needed leap forward.
What have you been hearing since introducing this bill in terms of pushback?
Very good question. Honestly, I haven't heard that much opposition. Certainly, there are people who are concerned with the impact on their own sector. And certainly, just like we heard with, for example, the ban on polystyrene, you know, there are people who will dispute the science, the dangers of these chemicals. And of course, we're going to hear that in every bill. But in fact, the research and the science is so significantly both robust and clear. There really isn't any doubt that PFAS, which, you know, was just introduced, Laura Spark from Clean Water Action said this yesterday, just introduced in 1948, and it's now in nearly every single human being alive. And it's going to stay there and accumulate because it just never goes away. So the kind of urgency to turn off the tap, as I call it, is because this chemical, this non-stick, water or stain resistant kind of chemical is so widespread, right? Teflon pans, carpets that have stain remover protection. It's so widespread and it's in, virtually all homes in the Commonwealth. The reason that we have to have a full class ban of it is that it is in this short while everywhere, and therefore it is in all of us. And causing harm even as you and I speak.
Out of curiosity, if you take PFAS away from a carpet or a kid's seat in a car or cosmetics, what does that do to the product? Does it still work? Does it still fulfill its intended purpose?
Really good question. In fact, and you might have, if you were listening yesterday, you would have heard from some of the manufacturers speaking about this. There are other chemicals out there. There are other ways to construct a product that don't rely on PFAS. Remember, it's not a chemical that's been around forever. We had products before PFAS and we'll have them after PFAS. And there are currently many products created without PFAS. So, it's a choice we make to put PFAS or one of the class of 9,000 PFAS chemicals, right, into a product. Just a choice. And so we can construct these things without them just as easily.
This is one of a number of environmental questions, pressing issues that are out there these days. You have said that you have a particular interest in PFAS. Why is that? Where did that come from?
Well, I proudly represent the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. At the University of Massachusetts, there is something called a wet lab. It is a water and environmental technology lab. At that lab is a gentleman named Dr. David Rekow. He is world-renowned in PFAS. He has assembled a cadre of, just astounding academics on the issue of PFAS. They're both dealing with mitigation. So how do we get rid of it? And the answer to that is it's sometimes impossible and always shockingly expensive. And then also, what is it doing to us? And that the answer, of course, is it's just an array of potential physical threats. And then they're going even deeper. They're asking questions like, is it transmittable in utero? The answer is yes. Our babies can be born with PFAS if the mother has PFAS in her system. So I've been woken up by this significantly wonky, passionate, dogged group of people I represent. They brought this issue to me. And this is just now a couple of years, because I'm only serving in my third year, constituents are bringing the issue to me saying, yes, we have to make a green transition. Yes, it's imperative for our climate, but we can't turn our back on toxic chemicals like PFAS, like polystyrene, like the chemicals that are of concern to pollinators, you know, we really have to take action on that, because these are both harming the environment, but they're also harming human health at the very same time.
You've said that cleanup from this type of chemical is shockingly expensive. Do you know how big is that number off the top of your head?
It really depends. And I actually asked this question myself. It depends on the level of PFAS. It depends on the kind of water source. It depends on the type of PFAS. There are both short and long chain. You probably know this. And the science is still emergent on this. So if Dr. Reckow were talking to you now, he would say cleanup is not assured. If you have a PFAS contamination, depending on what you're facing, if you are trying to mitigate or clean up, so-called clean up, the technology and the kind of intensity is just not cheap.
Senator Joe Comerford, thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing.
Really nice of you to have me. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk with a local activist in the Berkshires who's fighting with his town council over placement of a waste facility that they say could poison the Housatonic River. And Another Thing, we'll be right back.
You're listening to New England Public Media. The economy started strong this year as we caught up with all the dinners and haircuts we've been missing. Coming up on Marketplace, we'll take a look at what happens when that pent-up demand is spent. Marketplace is just ahead at 6:30 on New England Public Media and on your smart speaker. And Another Thing on New England Public Media is funded by you and Dean's Beans Organic Coffee, creators and funders of the Kids Stimulus Package, a school feeding program for children throughout Western Massachusetts, deansbeans.com. Mostly clear tonight with lows in the mid-40s, sunny tomorrow with highs in the lower 80s, partly cloudy tomorrow night, a slight chance of showers overnight, a low around 50, and mostly sunny on Friday with a slight chance of showers, highs in the lower 80s. It's New England Public Media.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Dara Kennedy. We continue our look into the undetectable chemicals that harm us and turn our attention toward the river. The Housatonic River Initiative is fighting a different kind of deterrent that can also cause lasting harm, the dumping of PCBs. Tim Gray has pledged there shall be no discharge of waste into the river. But the battle continues among town leaders, who will hold an annual meeting tomorrow, the initiative, and big business. Tim Gray tells us more.
Well, the rest of the river agreement is an agreement that came about from years and years of Berkshire County pushing. Actually, the Housatonic River Initiative was the lead for the last 25 years. It set the stage for a major cleanup in the river. Originally, it also set the stage for cleaning up hundreds of houses and properties around the city of Pittsfield, businesses and things like that that were all contaminated. And then it also set up a process called the Rest of the River Process, which is what we're going through now, which is to take care of everything below the first 2 miles from the GE plant. The first 2 miles was completed back in around 2000. And now we were at the next stage where we're looking at basically from where that cleanup ended all the way down to Long Island Sound. And there was a permit in 2016 put out by EPA that people were sort of okay with. But then GE sued because they didn't like what was in that permit, and this real bogus mediation started, which I can tell you about if you're interested. But they they went ahead and they sued, and then they got away with creating a major PCB dump in our community that was forced in our community with no vote. Never being told by our town leaders that they were going to sign this contract, and then did sign it behind our backs. And so we're in a big mess out here in Berkshire County right now. There's all sorts of things wrong with this dump. It's in a sand pit. They're trying to build this dump in a well-known sand pit. And it's 1,100 feet from the Housatonic River up in the air. So it's pretty outrageous. And our town has banded together. Our selectmen signed under this contract. They never gave us a vote in the town of Lee, never told us. It was done behind closed doors. And the citizens of Lee are suing the selectmen. And my group, the Housatonic River Initiative, is in court right now. And we are taking action against the GE and the EPA.
Gray said that the EPA has assured the town the facility will be safe, but they have, in the same breath, also recommended that anyone in Lee who uses well water should decommission their wells.
You know, when you have a well, you generally want a well because you want to drink better water, and also you don't want to pay the town for water. So the GE will hook you up to town water, but then you got to pay for it the rest of your life. The whole thing has been secret, the whole thing, And we are really discouraged by the process that's going on in our town. You know, it's been all these big wellness organizations have been spending, you know, $100 million plus to renovate the entire place. And then here these civic leaders of our community sign on to this dump behind people's backs. And voila, we have a mess on our hands. Well, at the annual meeting, the PCB issue is going to be hot. There are warrants on the articles that some of them were for, some of them were against, and there's going to be a lot of people there, and it's probably going to be a very, you might say, a spicy town meeting because everybody in this town is pretty much against the dump. This town battle's been going on since they announced the dump. We eventually formed the Housatonic River Initiative, which is an organization that's pretty much been dedicated to trying to get the PCBs out of our river and out, what turned out to be out of our homes in the city of Pittsfield and out of businesses in the city of Pittsfield. So we have one of the most PCB-contaminated rivers in the country. In this day and age, there's better alternatives than just dumping it. We've been in touch and we've held over the last 20 years, HRI, my group, and we've been having people from all these different companies come up and educate us for years and years. And we believe there's technology that exists right now that we could be using that would render the PCBs harmless and there wouldn't be a need for a dump. We think that's the best solution, but of course EPA is having none of it. Our local joke is we call it the EPA's Office of No Innovative Technology.
That was Timothy Gray, the director of the Housatonic River Initiative. Thanks to our guests for joining us today, and thank you for listening. A reminder, we welcome your comments at 800-639-9120. I'm Dara Kennedy. Thanks for listening.
You can follow us on social media. We are at Hello and Another, or email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org. I'm Maya Schwader. We'll see you tomorrow.